live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have a lot on health and healing to share, including for the men who feel, well, they have depression. You might not know it's because you have low testosterone, and we'll tell you what to do about it to get your natural and free testosterone back up. I've had some inquiries about what is AMPK activator. People are not quite certain about how it impacts aging. I'll share that with you as well. Also today, beets are defeating cancer. That's important. And a study, restaurant meals can be as bad as your, well, as your fast food meal for your waistline. And also, repeated courses of antibiotics have a profoundly negative impact upon the gut and the bacteria in the gut. And if you're feeling impulsive or frustrated, take a nap. Why? I'll share that with you. Also today, a more in-depth discussion about California's drought. It's really the canary in the coal mine. Maud Barlow and the Council of Canadians. It's interesting. You'll want to hear this. And I'll also tie that in with something that I looked around the American media. I couldn't find anything on it, and that is how Israel has weaponized water. We hear about it in no single media, and I'll discuss that and what it means and how it ties in with what's going on in California. Also, I'm going to take some time today to explain from my perspective what really is going on in Greece, what has gone on in Spain and Ireland and other countries in the European Union, austerity programs, what they really mean, and who got the money. All those billions, over $370 billion in debt, does that mean that banks loaned the Greek government that amount of money? No, it doesn't. The untold story behind the Greek crisis and what I suggest the Greek people do to resurrect their once great nation. And then I'll see how much time we have. And just another broadcast, our studios will be completely operational. We have a whole team, 7 craftsmen in here working today, and another 3 days, and we are 100% state-of-the-art studios where you'll be able to call in and we can get our guests. So I'm looking forward to that. That'll be on our next broadcast. Let's begin. You've seen the ads on television. Do you suffer from low testosterone? And in which case, take this medication. The trouble is that can increase your risk of a heart attack. Now, it is true that a lot of men over the age of 35 have reduced testosterone. And we know that a low testosterone can lead to, well, reduced libido, less energy, cloudy thinking. It'll cause weight gain, even cardiovascular diseases. But a lot of people are not aware that it also can impact your mood. Now, this is from George Washington University Medical Center, and it was published in the Journal of Sexual Medicine, and I'll quote it verbatim. It says, quote, researchers at George Washington University, led by Dr. Michael Irwin, found that men referred for tertiary care for borderline testosterone levels had much higher rates of depression and depressive symptoms than those within the general population. Quote, in an era where more and more men are being tested for low or lower levels of testosterone, there is very little data about the men who have borderline low testosterone levels. That's why they did this study. And they found out that depressive symptoms or depression is much higher. It was present in 56% of the men who had low testosterone. So what do we learn from this? We learned that your depression could be due to having lower testosterone. Nothing in your life, nothing that is happening that could cause you to feel depressed. Now, there are other reasons for depression, which should also be understood. But But it's not due to a brain chemical imbalance. That has been a lie, and the drugs to treat depression are dangerous, cause a lot of men to commit suicide. So what can you do? You can increase your exercise. That will increase also your testosterone. And you can get off the meat. Because the more meat you eat, the more animal proteins, the more your estrogen level goes up. And when you have an elevated estrogen level, you can impact your testosterone level. A plant-based diet is always good. And then what you can do supplement-wise really makes the difference. Much better than any of the medicines. I suggest that you start with about 1,000 to 1,300 milligrams of chrysin, C-H-R-Y-S-I-N, 20 milligrams of bioperine, B-I-O-P-E-R-I-N-E, 900 milligrams of Muira Puama, M-U-I-R-A, P-U-A-M-A, 200 milligrams of nettle root, N-E-T-T-L-E, 15 milligrams of zinc, and then one of the most important things is maca. Great, great root that's been known for centuries for its ability to stimulate libido and energy. M-A-C-A, maca, and around 300 to 400 milligrams. Also, Norway spruce lignin extract, about 30 milligrams. That would make the difference for so many men. And it's natural, it's non-toxic, it can help improve sex drive, increase energy, get better thinking, reduce weight, and help your cardiovascular system without drugs. One of the ways that we can make a difference in helping the planet and helping our health, helping the environment, is to go vegan. Now, for a lot of people, this is simply not realistic for them based upon their religious practices or their cultural practices or their family dynamics. So I certainly appreciate how challenging it may be. It's easy to say, well, go vegan. It's something else to live in someone else's shoes and understand what they may be faced with. I can't tell you how many people have come to see me and said, you know, I don't want my spouse to know I'm here because they don't believe in any of this. They think it's all nonsense. They're meat and potatoes, and that's it. And fast foods, I can't change them. And indeed, we can't change people, nor do we even have a right to. Outside of our children are those who are under our care, and we have a moral and legal responsibility to them to give them the best input we can. As adults, we must respect the boundaries between being an inspiration to someone, hopefully, so when they decide to make a change, they know that we're there to support them because people need a support system when they're going through change and transition. And thinking that all we need are the facts and we can do it. Well, I've seen a lot of people have a lot of facts. I haven't seen a lot of people make a lot of change. So it's important, even for these hoarders. By the way, I've actually seen a very wealthy hoarder. I was in their home. I couldn't believe how many things they managed to squeeze into this house that they never used. So hoarding's not just for poor people. But show me one of those hoarders who was able to unclutter their lives without help. Almost always we need help. But a lot of times people have that ego issue and or that sense of people would think I'm less than who I am if I ask for help. Indeed, we all need help at different times, and I believe that we should be looking more at the we of our future than the me. And my generation prided ourselves, and we could do it all. You know, we were invincible. We were smart, well-educated, the most educated group in American history, went further, created more inventions. Yeah, we did all that. And we became the worst parents in world history. And we bought the love of our children. And we forgot about the environment. And we went to Woodstock and got lazy and got stoned and forgot there was a world we can engage in. I was just in Woodstock, and I can tell you when I asked them, how many of you feel like you opened the closet door after 35 years and saw someone inside saying, hey, dude, is there any outside? Yeah, there's a world outside. Come and join it. And we're broadcast every day in Woodstock. There are activists there, but only a tiny number. Most of the people who live in Woodstock, that you wouldn't recognize, completely different than what it was when it was really a wonderful place. But that's also true of Sedona. It's true of Boulder. It's true of Taos. It's true of Santa Fe. All the great places at one time have changed. So if you want to change, more often than not, you got to say, I need some help, and not be afraid. Keep the ego out. Keep low self-esteem out. So when you become a vegan, don't hesitate in seeking support. The meter may, in your life may be angry at you, and that's okay. Don't personalize it. Because when you choose to go vegan, you're making one step away from all that water consumption for the animals, including in California where they need that water and it shouldn't be going to the animals, for all the other things that come from the pollution, the methane gases, all that I spoke about in my letter to the Pope yesterday. And I posted that, so I hope that the people in this audience read it, because it's for everyone, and then maybe encourage your local nuns and priests and parishioners to try it. In any case, from the Journal of General Internal Medicine, there's a really good article, and it's about a review of vegetarian diet studies highlight benefits of a vegan eating plan. Quote, people on a vegetarian diet, especially those following a vegan one that includes no animal products, see better results than dieters on other weight-reducing plans. In fact, they can lose around 2 kilograms more, 2.2 pounds per kilogram, you're talking about 5 pounds on a short term. And this is according to the Journal of General Internal Medicine. So on all levels, being on a healthy vegan diet allows you to live a longer life, a healthier life. Now, the omega-3 fatty acids are important, and antioxidants are important. Put the two together, and according to the University of California study, a major study that was published in the FASEB Journal for Scientists, quote, more evidence that fish oil supplements and antioxidants might be beneficial for at least some people facing Alzheimer's disease. This is a new report just out. And these are people that were patients over a 4 to 17 month period, and the findings suggest that it works. Prevention of mild cognitive impairment progression is one of the best hopes. That's according to the professor who were in the study. So take your omega-3s, 2 to 3,000 milligrams a day, and take your antioxidants, vitamin E, vitamin C, coenzyme Q10. That's what helps you. And I suggest you taking your antioxidants ideally 5 times a day, minimally 3 times, so you always have it in your system. Now, for those of you who eat out a lot, and most Americans do, just be aware that you're going to get fat, and we're already obese as a nation, but now we're talking about a good study showing you how fat you can be. This is from the University of Illinois, published in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Quote, when Americans go out to eat, either at a fast food outlet or a full service restaurant, they consume on average 200 more calories a day than when they stay home for meals. They also take in more fat, saturated fat, cholesterol, and sodium than those who prepare and eat their meals at home. These are the findings of University of Illinois kinesiology and community health professor who analyzed 8 years of nationally representative data from the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey of 18,000 adults. So, quote, people who ate at full-service restaurants consumed significantly more cholesterol per day than people who ate at home. All right, what's the message here? Well, we enjoy eating out as a society, but also there's a movement towards eating in, going to local markets, buying your fresh produce, locally grown, or your health food store, your food co-op, bringing it home, looking for wonderful recipes, trying different cuisine tastes and flavors. So you have one of two extremes. You have those people who never eat in and always eat every meal out. interesting because last night I wanted to get a juice, and it was late, and I also wanted to catch a late film, and which I would recommend. It's at the Plaza Theater, and it's a small film. It's a minimalist film, but it's very well written, very well done, and it takes place in 1990 with one Muslim man, young boy, who's so bright in his village that he wins a scholarship to be in the most prestigious Jewish school. And this is before the wall was built. And it shows the relationship of this one boy who's quiet, self-effacing, but very bright, when he's in the school and in effect being educated and in many times indoctrinated into the real history as he was being spoon-fed it. And the most interesting scene in the whole movie, and it was just brilliantly written. You would have expected Terry Sutherland to have written this. He wrote Network. And where he says, there was the teacher said, and what do you think of this? And instead of just giving a simple little answer, he gave a whole discussion about all the different philosophers and writers and how they were wrong, how they were telling people what the government wanted them to hear rather than the truth of history. It's a brilliant. And it's a little story, but in any case, it. And then I was thinking, wow, boy, have things changed today. And they have. In any case, it's worth seeing. But when I was getting my juice, a guy came over to me, and he said, you know, I'm feeling a whole lot different now that I'm juicing each day. And I said, how so? He said, well, I never really understood the juice thing. To me, a glass of juice was having a glass of orange juice out of a bottle. And that was it. And he said, I just didn't think it was worth it. And, you know, I would come by here and see people standing in line to get their juice. And then I had a condition. And my condition was a serious condition. I started taking the medicines, and they made me feel worse. Until finally, I decided, what the heck, maybe there's another approach. So I started hearing about the power of juicing to help the body, and I started doing some juicing, and just one a day, and now I'm on four a day, glasses of juice, and all my previous conditions have cleared up. I'm on no meds, and my original condition is completely healed. Plus, other conditions have improved. I had elevated blood pressure, elevated blood sugar, I had elevated low-density lipoprotein cholesterol. All have come down. Now I look forward to coming in and seeing different combinations I can have. And there was just an example of someone who said that he never ate in, always ate out, and would go to his favorite restaurants, and he always ate things at restaurants he had never eaten at home. And because it was just convenience, it was there. You know, if you're given bread, and you know, you eat the bread. If you're giving breadsticks, you eat the breadsticks before your meal. And at home, he never ate a dessert, but when he ate out, he always ate a dessert because they would always bring around the dessert menu, say, would you like some dessert or a dessert tray? So he ate it. So all these things changed. And then he says to me, he says, Gary, he says, do you know where I could find a doctor replace my old doctors? He said, my doctor was Dr. Feldman. I said, sure. There's a list of about 10 doctors in the New York area who have taken over his patients. And I gave him a number to call. And he said, I don't understand it. I just don't understand how he died. He was not old. And he was probably the most respected and loved holistic doctor in the New York area. I said, probably. I said, well, one of the reasons he died is one of the reasons that you nearly died. He never ate in. Now, I was his best friend and his oldest friend. We had a long friendship. I remember him coming when I was on the air before WBAI, when I was on WMCA. He used to come on and went to every lecture, every retreat. And he said, did you know he got into Yale at 16? I said, yep. And he was number one in Yale, number one in the graduate school, and number one at college physicians and surgeon. He was a very bright man. Well, how does someone that bright ends up dying? because I heard on from someone in his staff that how he died. I said, well, he died of a heart attack from autotoxemia. That means that he was constipated and he had impactation. And when you have an impaction of bad food, and that's food you're going to get when you every food comes from a deli or a Chinese restaurant. And there was a running joke, he never plugged in his refrigerator at his home. And you're not exercising. You're not taking all the supplements you should. You're not juicing. You're eating every meal out or having it sent in. And that salmon was farm-raised salmon. What do you think your gut's going to be like? Because exercise helps speed up peristalsis. It helps you digest. And having those juices you're having help create a nice alkalinity. Eating the other food creates an acid base. When you're sitting all day, then you slow down peristalsis. You slow down your digestive tract. And anytime you have fat in a meal, that super slows it down. Anytime your body has fat, it's like a traffic going at 60 miles an hour suddenly slows down to 5 miles an hour. And the longer that's in there, the more toxic reaction that the food has on the bowel and on the gut. And then you just become really impacted. And he was impacted. And he would have never allowed any of his patients to do what he did. And that's part of the limitation. And I've said this many times. In fact, when I was reviewing the film, Overcoming the Dark Side, Marty's in the audience. And one of the things I said in that film was that all of us master many different things. Some master being a great friend, good at their jobs. Most people are good at their jobs. They master being a parent and a caregiver. But they don't always master their own life. They've mastered someone else's life. They're just living in someone else's life. But it's not their own. Therefore, there's not an authentic synchronicity of these energies. And that's what makes someone different. And from the outside, you can't see it. Everything looks perfect. It's the inside. Because what happens when you don't master your own authentic life is that you have a limitation. And that limitation will be an anchor. And that anchor is like you dressing up, feeling great, being groomed, and ready to go into a parade that's all about you. And you take one step, and boom, there's a giant bolt in the floor of concrete, and it's wrapped around your waist, and you can't get out of it. That's your limitation. So the takeaway message is, no matter what your strengths, no matter what your qualities and assets, no matter what good you have done or are, that must be weighed against the dark side, the limitations, the fear, insecurity, anxiety. Stated or unstated, conscious or unconscious, it's there. And that will yank you back. And so you can't be on your own road, in your own parade. You can visualize it, you can fantasize about it, you can think about it, you can hope for it, you can wish for it, you can do all that. It won't make a difference. We must be honest, turn around, face our fears, our limitations, our weaknesses, and walk in the direction of what we fear most. Embrace what we fear most and try to understand the impact that that has had, the power that has had on all of our choices. 3 days before Marty died, we went to a movie together, had dinner together, and I saw that he was in distress. And I said, Marty, come. I'm going out of town, but I'll take a couple weeks. You don't have to prove anything to anyone. Come and just help yourself, and I'll help you. I saw from his expression, I'd seen it before, the answer was no. And so even the people we care about in our lives, our mothers, our fathers, our grandparents, all the people we know, if they made a different choice, there'd be a different outcome. We have to stop at that barrier that says, I am a person of free will. Allow me to make my choices, even if they're wrong. And that's why we have to understand the power of a conditioned mind. So when I said to this gentleman, so now you've made choices, but would you have made those choices to come out and drink your glasses of juice each day and to take that walk, as you said, you're walking from Columbia University, where your professor down here, and said you wouldn't have, would you have done this if you'd not been diagnosed with a condition that was serious and could be life-threatening? He said, nope. He said, no. He says, you know, you get to a place in life, and he was very honest, and I appreciate your honesty. He said, well, he said, you can be honest when you're not defending your ego. Well said. And he said, there are those of us in life who have so many people come to learn from us, and most of my friends who are professors suffer from this also, that you forget what you don't know is just the effort to continue learning, and we stop. And as a result, we don't grow anymore. And we think if I'm successful, if I'm accomplished, I don't need to know anymore. And then I responded to him, do you realize how many famous people, from rap stars to basketball players, football players, they go broke? Not because they didn't make enough money. They made too much money, but they stopped their growth. They stopped their spiritual growth. They stopped their emotional growth. They stopped their intellectual growth. They stopped their social integration growth. It was all about them, and then surrounding themselves with the parasites, from the agents to the managers, from the lawyers to the crews, to the posses that live off of you. All they care about is you continue to feed them and not that you stop and grow. Think of the difference if all those ball players who today are broke, if they would have said, I might be successful playing basketball and earning $20 million a year or whatever it is, but I have a lot of growth to do, and I've got to balance my life with that time each day for growth. They wouldn't be broke today, nor would they be on drugs. So we had a very interesting conversation. That's why I love the Upper West Side and other places too. That's not the only place. In fact, tomorrow I'm going to be on the Lower East Side, where there's going to be a whole lot of heady intellects, and it'll be fun to see how they're celebrating that day and what they have to share. The whole idea is everybody has to share something that will impact everyone else in a positive way. So I look forward to that. Just some reflections. Finally, the benefits of beets. Now, you know that having a glass of beet juice before you exercise thins your blood, oxygenates your blood, and allows nitric oxide, which helps prevent a heart attack or stroke. And that's why when you go out to exercise, you should always have a glass of juice before you do, beet juice. Here's the latest on beet juice, or beets. This root vegetable, which, you know, is loaded with potassium and phosphorus and calcium and sulfur, iodine, good for your thyroid gland, by the way, and it has a whole lot of benefits, and the science is now showing it can benefit with cancer. From the Department of Internal Disease, and in Hungary, they had a study showing its benefits on cancer patients, helping in remission in cancer patients. And this was published in Australian International Clinical Nutrition Review. In one study, a 50-year-old man suffering from lung tumor, which corresponded clinically to lung cancer, was treated with beetroot. In just 6 weeks, the tumor had disappeared, and after 4 months, the man gained back just over 20 pounds that he had lost. His blood work results corresponded to clinical recovery. In another study, a prostate cancer sufferer and uterine cancer patient were both admitted to the hospital. Now, at the time of admission, both weighed the same. The man with the prostate cancer received beetroot treatment, but the doctor noted that the uterine cancer patient could not take it. And although he had been bedridden with a catheter when admitted, the man was able to have his catheter removed after a month and soon began walking around and putting back on weight. And the female patient, however, continued to lose weight. And after 3 months, there was a weight difference of 23 pounds between the two. So why is it that beets are so important? And the secret may be in the beet's ability to ward off cancer lie in its red color, because that's where the power is. the ability to assimilate iron from the beetroot more readily than from most other foods, or almost any other food. And because beets are vegetable and healthy to eat, the biggest advantages to the cancer-fighting benefits of beet juice is that you don't have to worry about harmful side effects from their consumption. Now, I'm not suggesting one food is going to be the answer. That would be ridiculous. But as a part of an overall healthy diet, it can make the big difference. Just 2 teaspoons of beet juice a day, you can add it to water or any other juice, could make a difference, especially if you have cancer. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. Before we take a break, let's share something from Maud Barlow and the Council on Canadians. It's a good article, and it's entitled California's Drought, the Canary in the Coal Mine. Quote, California Governor Jerry Brown ordered officials to impose mandatory water restrictions in his drought-stricken state for the first time in history. The news was carried around the world. Climate change was named as the culprit, and it is. Glaciers are melting in the Arctic, and drastically reduced snowfall in the Sierra Nevada mountains has lowered the amount of runoff that the state depends on for water renewal. But there's another side effect to this, and the human abuse and mismanagement of water is actually a cause of climate change, and that needs to be placed at the center of our thinking about environmental destruction and regeneration. In this sense, California is the canary in the coal mine of a growing water crisis that's happening everywhere. We have to transform our thinking, action, and relationships to this most precious of resources. Quote, for decades, there has been massive engineering of the state's water supplies through pipelines, canals, and aqueducts in order to supply a small number of powerful farmers in California's Central Valley. 80% of all water in California goes to agriculture, much of it to grow water-intensive crops for export. Alfalfa hay, for example, which is mostly exported to Japan, uses 15% of the entire state's water. Almonds, by the way, 80% of the world's production of almonds is in California, uses 10%. Absent renewable water supplies, industrial farming has taken to mercilessly mining groundwater to produce their crops. If the rains don't come soon, and there's no sign they will, groundwater will be depleted in many parts of the state. But instead of challenging these practices, California's new restrictions only apply to urban centers and not to the big agriculture producers who hold powerful political sway in the state. For years, there has been a free-for-all as large industrial farms. Smaller ones, no, you don't get the benefit. But the large ones, yes. And that is the danger. The restrictions also don't apply to many fracking and bottled water operations like Nestle's throughout the state that are harming and depleting local water supplies. In fact, oil producers just in California last year used 280 million liters of water for fracking. The problem in California, as in many parts of the world, is that water is seen as a resource for convenience and profit and not as the essential element of an ecosystem that gives us life. Water is increasingly treated as a form of private property, and powerful forces resist any attempt by governments to limit their consumption and trading. Against this backdrop, we're living with this myth of abundance, believing that we can never run out of water. But like most myths, this one is wrong. The United Nations now says that we have 15 years to avert a worldwide, full-blown water crisis. Demand for water will outstrip supply by 40% throughout the globe. 500 scientists brought together by the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon have concluded that the collective abuse of water has already caused the planet to enter a new geologic age, a planetary transformation akin to the retreat of the glaciers 11,000 years ago. The majority of the world's population lives within 30 miles radius of water sources that are badly impaired or running out. More children die of waterborne disease than all other forms of violence put together, including war. Now, how are our world leaders and global institutions dealing with this? Very badly, and with no plan. When water is discussed at world gatherings, it is seen as a byproduct of climate change. there's little understanding that removing water from water retention landscapes affects the climate in dramatic and negative ways. Cutting down the Amazon rainforest has led to a perilous drop in rainfall, for example. For the first time in living memory, the once water-rich city of Sao Paulo in Brazil is experiencing severe drought. Legal systems in most countries don't protect the earth because they aren't meant to. In fact, our legal and political establishments perpetuate, protect, and legitimize the continued degradation of the earth by design, not by accident. Most laws to protect the environment and other species only regulate the amount of damage that can be inflicted by human activity. So what are the solutions? Well, private industry should not be allowed to own or control water, and anyone found polluting water must be denied future access. Water is the common heritage of humanity and of future generations. It must never be bought, hoarded, sold, or traded on the open market. Water services must be publicly owned and delivered on a non-for-profit basis. Governments must place priorities on access to limited supplies, especially of groundwater. Water is also a human right, and lack of access to clean water and sanitation is the greatest human rights issue out there right now in the South, global South. But lack of access to water is no longer confined to poor countries. In the name of austerity, thousands of people in the United States and Europe have had their water services cut off. In Detroit, for example, because they cannot afford the high price of water imposed as part of the plan to balance the city's budget. To combat these problems, we need a global plan of action that includes watershed protection, conservation, restoration, national community programs to replenish water retention landscapes, watershed sharing and governance, models of food and energy production that do not harm water. And from my own perspective, I believe that what we could do is start to look at all the states in America where we could grow everything that's grown in California, but that has plenty of water, and grow them in those areas so that we take this concentration of all this agriculture and move it. And that's what I see the future to be. I believe that people will start learning to do hydroponics. That is, the future is in, it is inevitable. That, I believe, will be the single most important determining factor of food production in the future. I'm not talking about the far future. I'm talking about within the next 5 years. Those of you who get ahead of this curve and start growing hydroponically, you will have yourself a very good supply of food, even enough to then turn around and offer at a good, reasonable price to the society that you live in. And there's lots of places we should be growing food, and we don't grow anything. So that's what we have to do, in my opinion. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us. One last thing about how, this is from Lyth Shacker from Counterpunch, how Israel weaponized water. And I'll skip over the part about California. I've just dealt with that. And dying of thirst, despite its location in a region thought to be perennially dry, the Holy Land actually has ample natural freshwater resources, namely in the form of underground aquifers in the Jordan River. Palestinians in the West Bank and Israeli settlers live in roughly equal proximity to these resources, which theoretically would allow for equal consumption. Israeli water policy, however, has made this prospect virtually impossible. In fact, there's a shocking disparity. A report from the United Nations found that the average Israeli settler consumes 300 liters of water per day, a figure surprisingly even averaging what the Californians, 290 per day. But thanks to Israeli military action and legal restrictions on access, the average Palestinian in the occupied West Bank only gets 70 per day. And for the tens of thousands of Palestinians who live off the water grid, daily consumption hovers around 30. That's just 10% of the Israeli figure. Both figures are well below the minimum 100 liters a day recommended by the World Health Organization. And while Israelis are watering their lawns and swimming pools and Olympic-sized pools, Palestinians, a few miles away, are literally dying of thirst. And this is where water has been weaponized. This inequality has deep roots, and it's no accident. Almost immediately after the creation of Israel in 1948, the fledgling country took comprehensive action to secure control of the region's water. And these policies were ramped up again following the 1967 Arab-Israeli War, when Israel first assumed control of the Palestinian territories. That year, the Israeli Army Forces issued Military Order 92, an initiative that put Palestinian water resources under Israel's military jurisdiction. This was shortly followed by Military Order 158, which required Palestinians to obtain permits from the military in order to build new water infrastructure. If they built new wells, springs, or even if you collected rainwater off your home, you could not do it without Israeli permission. Soldiers would confiscate or destroy, often without prior notification. Those orders, among others, remain on the books today. They form the basis for the administration of water access to 4.4 million Palestinians. And although control of water resources is now officially the domain of Mekorot, Israel's national water company, Israel forces routinely perform operations with the explicit intent of destroying Palestinian water infrastructure. Decades of peace negotiations have done little to grant Palestinians sovereign control over their resources. Even after the Oslo Accords of the early 1990s, which were supposed to grant the Palestinians some semblance of political agency in the territories, water access remains limited. In fact, the accords simply codified the unfair distribution of water in the region, imbuing these flagrantly harmful practices with a veneer of illegality. Even in Palestinian-administered portions of the West Bank, Israeli troops regularly demolish rain cisterns, pipelines, and agricultural water structures. Human rights groups have meticulously documented a number of these instances, compiling them in a report examining the extent of the hardship these operations cause to West Bank residents. One case study detailed the destruction of a farmer's well in a village east of Jenin. His well, along with five others in the area, were destroyed by the military under the pretext that it had been built without proper authorization by Israel, despite the fact that he had proper permits and authorization by Israel. Didn't matter. They do what they want to do. These operations showcase the coordination between civil military channels to restrict Palestinian access to water, a system that's been startlingly effective in its goal. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. And on July 26th, Sunday at noon, I'll be in Huntington, Long Island at the Huntington Arts Cinema, premiering my new feature documentary, Saving the Planet. If you'd like to join me, call 631-423-7611, 631-423-7611. I believe they just charge whatever a regular ticket is. And you also receive from me a gift of one copy of the film. So that's July 26, noon, Huntington Arts Cinema. And I have a large group of listeners out on Long Island, and they don't always get into the city to see the premiere, so I do it out there for them. 631-423-7611. I'd like to spend our remaining time dealing with the issue of Greece, sharing different perspectives, one from Professor William Polk of Harvard, also one from the Bloomberg Economist, my own perceptions on this very important issue, and sharing some insights that the average person is probably not aware of when hearing people talk about, what happens with the Greek debt. I believe that we need a history lesson first, so we have a better context of understanding today. From Consortium News, it's about focusing exclusively on the monetary aspects of the Greek crisis. But the media, now maybe I missed it. Have you seen anyone talking in the media about the Greek crisis that actually gives you the history over the last, let's say, 100 years of the Greeks? For over a half a century, Greece has been a perilous place. In the 1930s, they lived under the brutal dictatorship that modeled itself on Nazi Germany, employing Gestapo-like secret police and sending critics off to an island concentration camp. And then a curious thing happened. Mussolini invaded the country. And challenged to protect their own self-respect in their country, Greeks put aside their hatred for the dictatorship that was going on at that time and rallied to fight the foreign invaders. And the Greeks did such a good job of defending their country that Adolf Hitler had to put off his invasion of Russia to rescue the Italians. That move probably saved Joseph Stalin, since the delay forced the Weimar to fight in Russia's mud, snow, and ice, for which they were not prepared. But ironically, it also saved the dictatorship and the monarchy. The king and all the senior Greek officials fled to British-occupied Egypt, and as new allies, they were declared part of the so-called free world. Meanwhile, in Greece, the Germans looted much of the industry and shipping and foodstuffs. The Greeks began to starve. And as Mussolini remarked, the Germans have taken from the Greeks even their shoestrings. Then the Greeks began to fight back. In October 1942, they set up a resistance movement that within 2 years became the largest in Europe. When France could claim less than 20,000 partisans fighting the Germans, the Greek resistance movement had enrolled 2 million and was holding down at least 2 divisions of German soldiers. And they did it without any outside help. As the war outcome became apparent, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill was determined to return Greece to the pre-war rule of the monarchs in the old regime, and he was motivated by fear of communism within the resistance movement. And Churchill tried to get the Anglo-American army that was getting ready to invade Italy to attack Greece instead. Indeed, he tried so hard to change the war plan that he almost broke up the Allied military alliance. And when he failed, he threw all of his soldiers he still had control over into Greece and precipitated a civil war that tore the country apart. Now, the underground leaders were outsmarted, and their movement was smashed. The bureaucracy, the police, and the programs of the pre-war dictatorships resumed control. After the war, with Britain out of money and no longer able to sustain its policy, London turned Greece over to the Americans, who announced the Truman Doctrine and poured money to prevent a leftist victory, and American money temporarily won the day, but the heavy hand of the former regime created a new generation of would-be Democrats who challenged the dictatorship. This is the theme beautifully evoked in that wonderful movie, if you haven't seen it, you should, Costa Gavras's film called Z, starring Yves Montaigne. Now, as the film shows, the liberal movement of the early 60s was overwhelmed by a new military dictatorship. They were called the rule of the colonels. And when the military was overthrown in 1974, Greece enjoyed a very brief period of normality. But none of the deep fissures in the society had been healed. Regardless of what political party chose the ministers, the self-perpetuating bureaucracy was still in control, which meant corruption was endemic in every agency, every office of the Greek government. And most importantly of all, Greece had become a political system that Aristotle would have called an oligarchy. The very rich used their money to create for themselves a virtual state within a state. They extended their power into every niche of the economy and so arranged the banking system that it became essentially extraterritorialized, and the Piraeus Harbor was filled with mega yachts owned by people who paid no taxes, and London was partly owned by people who fattened off the Greek economy. The smart money of Greece was stashed abroad. You have to have that understanding to understand the current crisis. This state of affairs might have lasted many more years, but when Greece joined the European Union in 1981, Europeans, mainly the Germans and the bankers, saw an opportunity. They flocked into Greece to offer loans. Nobody was turned down, Even those Greeks who had insufficient income to justify loans grabbed them. Then the lenders began to demand repayment. And shocked, businesses began to cut back, unemployment increased, opportunities vanished. There's really no chance that the loans will be repaid. They should never have been offered and never should have been accepted. To stay afloat, the government has cut back on public services, except for the military, and the people have suffered. In the 2004 election, the Greeks had not yet suffered enough and to vote out the radical coalition that led to the problems. But then, after the crash of 2008 and hardships worsened, disapproval of all politicians and anger resulted, and they voted in the new unity government. So today, we don't have the Greece of old. But who caused this crisis? Well, you could say that not having any of the income from all the rich and major corporations, that certainly helped. By having bloated bureaucracies, that helped. By buying votes, that helped. By buying two submarines that they didn't need for over $1 billion from the Germans, that helped. And then they racked up a big debt. The debt is 322 billion euros, or somewhere in the neighborhood of around $360 billion. And yet, in the birthplace of democracy, Greece, not the United States, here's what one person had to say, Paul Krugman, explaining to the New York Times, austerity had been a dead end for Greece. So now what do we want? We want them to give the bankers and the bankers' friends all their private assets. We want to strip away pensions and fire even more government employees, even though 25% of all government employees have been fired. We want to strip away all guarantees and social systems. In effect, they want to take whatever assets exist, privatize everything, and that is what they've been putting the Greek population through. Quote, most of the Americans have heard about Greek irresponsibility is false. Yes, the Greek government was spending beyond its means in the late 2000s, but since then it has repeatedly slashed spending and raised taxes as required by the Troika. Government employment has fallen more than 25% and pensions have been cut sharply. If you add up all the austerity measures, they have been more than enough to eliminate the original deficit and turn it into a large surplus. So why didn't this happen? Because the Greek economy collapsed, largely as a result of those very austerity measures dragging revenues down with them. And this collapse in turn had a lot to do with the euro, which trapped Greece into an economic straitjacket. Cases of successful austerity in which countries rein in their deficits without bringing on a depression typically involve large currency devaluations that make their exports more competitive. This is what happened, for example, in Canada in the 1990s, and to an important extent, it's also happened in Iceland more recently. But Greece, without its own currency, didn't have the option, end quote. So what would I suggest? Get out of the euro, go back to your own currency. Yes, it will not have the same value as the euro, but then completely say goodbye to all your debt. Now, there's one other group in all this, and that's Goldman Sachs. Here's what the American public has not been told. At least I haven't seen it in any report. And this comes from Pam Martins and Russ Martins from the Wall Street on Parade. Quote, are Goldman Sachs executives Loing Blankfein and Gary Cohen losing any sleep over elderly pensioners waiting outside shuttered banks in Greece, desperately trying to obtain their pension checks to pay rent and buy food? Are these Goldman honchos feeling a small pang of conscience over the humiliation by creditors of this once proud country? No. Why? As a documentary of the BBC showed on Goldman Sachs' deal, it provides a layman's view of the dirty underbelly of the deal, called a toxic import from America. It has hastened the downfall of Greece. On March 5th, 2012, Dick Dunbar, who appears in the BBC documentary on Goldman Sachs' deal and author of The Devil's Derivatives, penned a revealing article for Bloomberg News. The writers describe the Goldman Sachs deal with Greece as follows. Quote, on the day of the 2001 deal was struck, the government owed the bank about $600 million euros. That's $790 million, more than the 2.8 billion euros it borrowed. And the man who took over the country's debt management agency in 2005, by then, the price of the transaction, mind you, let's go back, we're talking about $793 million transaction. The transaction, a derivative that disguised the loan, and the Goldman Sachs persuaded the government of Greece not to test with the competitors, had now gone up to 5.1 billion euros. You're now about $6 billion. Quote, a gain of 600 million euros represents about 12% of the 6.35 billion in revenue Goldman Sachs reported for trading in principal investments 2001. A business segment include the bank's fixed income, currencies, and commodities division, which reigned the trade and posted record sales. The revised deal proposed by the bank and executed in 2002 was the base payment repayments on what they then was a new kind of derivative, an inflation swap linked to the euro area harmonized index. In lay language, Goldman Sachs was one of the primary perpetrators of the debt. So the Greek government doesn't get all that money. It never had all that money. When they're getting money to repay the debt, that money they're getting goes back to the banks and the people who invested because they were getting high interest rates. So I suggest that if the world knew the truth, that the Greek public did not receive $270 billion. They're paying huge interest rates. They've made all these austerity programs. They've even privatized assets. They should default on the loan. They should go off the euro, get out of the European zone, and rebuild their economy from the get-go. And that's also true of some other nations. And if Greece does it, you bet, watch how long it takes before Spain, Portugal, and other countries do it. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.